The Mac Observer's Mac Geek Gab number 60 for July 3rd, 2006. Greetings, everybody. It's Dave and John from the Mac Observer's Mac Geek Gab, and we're here for yet another edition. How are you, John?
I'm kind of disoriented.
Are you? Well, yeah, it's daylight out.
Well, it's, yeah, I mean, I'm used to working for the man right now.
That's right. Yeah,
you get the... But I did, like many people, I did the four-day weekend option because I got all this vacation I got to take, so...
Apparently, I'm too much of a slave driver because just none of our little ventures here have the day off. So,
yeah, tell me about it.
Yeah, but that's all right. I get to podcast during the day, which is fun. So that's good. And it means we can all go and enjoy fireworks tonight because, of course, today is the 3rd of July. And in the U.S., that means it's part of our extended holiday weekend of the beginning of summer really is what it has become. Of course, it means a whole lot more than that in our nation's history, obviously. But,
we're it's celebrating just the summer. Yeah. Our independence from the man.
The man. That's right. We have so much to talk about here. We've got kind of went through the mailbag and cleaned out all the stuff about we've got Raid, some HDTV things, a swap, sort of all over the place. And then there's actually some stuff that's come up over the last couple of days since we prepared the agenda that we're going to have to somehow try and fit in. So...
Yeah, we got fireworks tomorrow.
Oh, okay. Yeah, we've got fireworks constantly, I think. There's some tonight. There's some tomorrow night. There's some, I don't know, whatever. Well, Jamie did send us a cool thing, though, that kind of fit into our Raid discussion that I wanted to include here. And what it is Jamie writes, he wrote it via email. He didn't send it in as an audio comment, but that's okay. Just listen to your latest show. I was inspired to send you this little Raid snippet. As you're both true geeks, I know you will really appreciate this. I did. Some guys have linked 13 USB floppy drives and rated them using hubs in an Apple iBook, and they call it the Mega Floppy, and there's a link to it in the show notes. Of course, Michael will probably have put a link here by now in the enhanced feed. Very, very cool. Did you check this thing out, John?
Not yet.
Oh, apparently these guys, they were cleaning out.
I gotta ask myself why.
Well, because they were cleaning out a closet and found a ton of these little Raid, or these little USB floppy drives and thought, you know. Yeah, so. And then Doug actually had something to say about an HDTV discussion. So.
Hey, guys, it's Doug from Connecticut, driving into work. I'm on my Bluetooth, so I'm got both hands on a wheel, so let you know.
Oh, boy.
Good.
Anyway, you had a listener call in the last show asking about TiVo, and then you also asked about any HDTV solutions for the Mac. I'm sure you've gotten quite a few responses from other people, but I'm going to give you my sense too. other than being an IT geek, I love HDTV, and I drive my wife crazy with it. But I have a ITV 500 hooked up to my PowerMac G5 FireWire external interface, and it has two interfaces on it, and one is for standard cable, and the other is for over-the-air HDTV broadcast. But, and here's a nice but, if you live in Connecticut, if you live in an area that broadcasts high definition over standard cable, and you hook up the standard cable to the second interface rather than just a normal antenna going to an aerial, I'm able to decode unencrypted QAM signals, which for me gives me about 20 to 30 HDTV quality broadcast channels. So I'm able to use it as a PBR, record, CBS, NBC, ABC, anything broadcast in HD. The files are big, about an hour, I think it's close to a gig.
Wow.
So you got a lot of storage space required for that, but it's a good solution, and Elgato also makes another product that ties into it called iHome, which will then stream that to any type of device that can decode those signals on your network. So I'm getting a link player from IO Media, which can take those signals, let me stream it down to my flash myself. A lot of good stuff going on, and it does support, the ITV does support HDTV to a point. I mean, hopefully Comcast is going to encrypt everything when they stop it, but right now I'm able to do a lot with it. So, it's a good solution, and it should work for users who might be interested in it. Okay, guys? See you later. Bye-bye.
Thanks, Doug. I'm not sure if the iHome will do the HD, though, right? I mean, I think from what I understand, I think it just connects to standard composite ports. Is that right? Is that right, John?
Beats me.
All right.
I don't have one.
Well, yeah, there you go. Maybe we need to get one and play with it. You don't have HD yet, so maybe it's time for you to experiment with this. We'll put you in touch with those people at iHome
and have you play. I'm looking at some of the... every now and then when I'm in the local warehouse store, I take pictures of whatever they have there just so I can research it online and see if it's something I want. I'm still concerned about getting decent quality with a non-HD signal. I think that's still an issue.
Yeah. That's why we wound up choosing the Panasonic plasma that you saw when you were here. Very, very important, folks, because there is quite a bit of stuff, obviously, that's not HD. And if you're going with, you know, a large screen, even 42 or bigger, you don't want something that's just going to stretch the standard def signal and not do any enhancements to it, because it can look pretty crummy. So,
Have you run into this? I looked this up. He mentioned QAM.
I haven't.
Are you familiar?
No.
Okay, I looked it up. It seems to be a modulation scheme for a digital cable, but he was saying that, and I'm wondering if there's like a QAM type of file you can save to. It kind of sounded like that. I don't know, but anyways, I was just wondering if, just a question, because I haven't looked at, you know, the what your options are for saving stuff when it's digital.
Yeah, so, I kind of assumed that each bit of software would save it in its own proprietary format, but maybe it's just saving it as MPEGs, right? I mean, it's possible, right?
Possible.
It should be. All right. Well, we gotta dig more into that. That's that we shall do. In the meantime, we'll help Josh with his issue, because I know it's one that's plagued. Well, certainly it's plagued both of us and Josh. So there's a quorum right there.
Hi guys, this is Josh calling from Shanghai, China. I have a quick question with Safari. I've been having trouble with Safari and reading PDFs ever since I installed Adobe Acrobat Reader. I used to just read PDFs through Preview or right in Safari. Actually, I'm running Tiger. But then after I installed Adobe Acrobat Reader, it now pops up a dialog box anytime I click on a PDF link, and it says, please select an Adobe Acrobat or Adobe Reader application to use. And I really don't want to use Adobe Reader, so I just hit cancel. And then after that, it looks like it's loading a PDF, but nothing actually shows in the window. And so what I have to do now, anytime I want to see a PDF, I have to right-click on it and then choose Download Linked File. And I wasn't sure if there's a way that I can keep Adobe Reader on my computer, but then be able to use the regular built-in Preview application for Safari anytime I want to actually view a PDF in Safari. So if you have any advice for how to handle this, then that would be great. Thanks a lot.
You want to take that one, John?
I'll start.
Good.
Because there's a lot behind this. The first thing you may want to do for people to wonder just what's happening in the background here and why is this weird thing happening, if you go to Safari and you go to the Help menu and you look at Installed Plugins, this is going to be where you can start solving this type of problem, but it also gives you some insight into why a browser does what it does. You will see when you make this choice in Safari, you'll see on the left MIME type. MIME is Multi-Purpose Internet Media Extensions, I think. But it's basically a way to add a code to a piece of media so the browser knows what to do with it. It's useful for email. Email programs use it. Browsers use it. A lot of things use it to kind of get a hint as to what to do with a piece of data. Like, for example, a graphic file will have a MIME type of, like, image/GIF, for example, or JPEG or whatever.
MIME type, just so you know, is actually set by the sending server, right? It's not set on your computer. You could have a list of MIME types, but as far as data coming into the browser, it's set by the sending server. So even if the file is just called test and it doesn't say test.pdf or test.doc, if somehow the server on the other end knows what it is, it will send the MIME type. Now, usually it's done. Usually the servers assign it based on file extensions, but it's certainly possible to do it other ways. So moving along.
Right. So a PDF file in this case, now I don't know but I think you may have another part of this answer here, but what happens is when you, so a PDF file has a type of application/PDF, I believe. Now, what will happen is if there is a plugin that handles that MIME type, the plugin in Safari will grab it. Now, what happens is when you install the Acrobat Reader, I'm pretty sure it's an option in the installer to do this, or it may...
It's not an option. I think it just happens.
You can't do a detailed install? Okay, well, that's bad.
Well, because, there's ways of turning it on and off, but...
Okay, because I haven't installed it for a while.
Yeah.
An installer could, I don't know if theirs does, give you the ability to say, please do not install an internet plugin. But it sounds like what happened is that an internet plugin was installed, and what that does is overrides the default behavior, which seems to be to launch the preview app.
Correct.
So what happens now, you're launching the plugin that then hands it off to the Acrobat Reader, which it sounds like some people may not want that. So what you can do is... Look, if you look at this list of plugins, you will see one here, and I'll look a little farther down. It will be the Adobe Acrobat and Reader plugin, and that is the thing that handles application/PDF, but it also tells you the name of the file, Adobe PDF Viewer.plugin. Hey, you know, boy, how can we find where that is? Oh, we can use Spotlight. So if you use Spotlight and you search for that file name, you will see it's in, I believe it's /library/internet-plugins. So if you look in there, you will see, Adobe PDF Viewer.plugin. So if you don't want, I think you probably want to quit Safari first. If you don't want it to use this plugin to view PDFs, I think something creates a disabled plugins in there, so you could drag it there for safekeeping or just get rid of it.
Yep.
And then the next time you start up Safari, anytime you start up almost any browser, it'll first look in its plugins folder to see what types of data it should be prepared to handle. So the next time you start it up, if that's not there, then whatever used to handle it before. And I'm unclear what maps that, but...
That's a WebKit thing, I believe, an Apple WebKit thing that maps PDFs to open either just in applications, any app, you know, Safari, even third parties like Yojimbo will open PDFs, and I'm pretty sure they're just using WebKit to go ahead and do that translation and display it. It's a service of the OS, and by having the Acrobat plugin there, Safari says, "Oh, well, something else is supposed to handle this, so I'm not even going to ask the OS to do it. I'll just, you know, pass it along to this plugin, and away it goes." And you're right, removing it from that folder will do it. But I believe there's even a more official way, or at least a more planned way. I think in Acrobat Reader, if you go to Preferences from the Adobe Reader menu and go to Internet from the list, there is an option that says Display PDF in Browser. And so if you uncheck that, then it will not use the Acrobat plugin anymore. I'm not sure, actually, if that just removes it from the plugins folder or not. I would assume it does because the browser otherwise wouldn't know what to do, so... That's two answers for the same thing, but it was a nice little tour. What's that?
What a deal! Two answers for one question. I mean it.
Yeah, but I like your description there because it kind of lets us troubleshoot other things as well and gives some geeky insight. Yeah.
So make a note of what you see in there because I saw some things actually I didn't expect. Like I saw a DRM plugin. QuickTime could be another cause of handling where you don't want it. QuickTime handles a lot of different stuff.
Yep.
But I think through the QuickTime preferences, you can set...
You can turn those on and off. That's right.
Yeah, because it handles a lot of things. And this is a headache on Windows, especially. I mean, a lot of Windows people have probably seen this. Especially if you're using multiple browsers, they'll all kind of come up and say, hey, you want me to be the default? Hey, you want me to be the default? Hey.
That's right, yeah. And that's actually a good point there. This folder is used not just by Safari, but it's also used by Firefox and any other browser. It is where system-wide plugins are installed. So if you have some plugin for, say, you know, Shockwave or Windows Media or whatever it is, put it in there, and all the browsers should, in theory, take advantage of it. You don't need to have it in multiple places like the old days with OS 9.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
There you go.
There you go.
I may have an add-on.
What's that?
Well, there is something called... Have you used this thing lately? Default app? Or RC default app?
No, you mentioned it before. Yeah.
Yeah, I'm taking a look at the latest version, and I think that's something that may also let you change mappings. Not through that, because that is kind of primitive. doing it through the browser and playing with stuff in that folder, though that's where it is. I think this...
Anyway,
I'll look over this and
Diablotin or whatever it was, right? Diablotin was another app that would let you do that. So, all right, but Bob had a question related to Safari, so here we go.
Hi, John and Dave. Bob here from Santa Barbara, California. I have a Safari question. I used to be able to type an address in the search area on top of Safari. I could just type the domain name, like MacGeekGab, and click return or enter, and Safari would put in the proper .com, or if there wasn't one, .org or whatever, at least it would get the .com. Now, I can't do that. I always have to at least type .com or .org or whatever it is. This happened after the JavaScript update a few weeks ago, and I wondered if there was some connection or if there's some file I can throw away to reset Safari. I've cleared my history. I don't really know what else to do. Cache, cookies. Anyway, appreciate your thoughts on that matter. Thank you.
You don't need to send us cash or cookies. We're happy to just do this because we
I was going to say
it.
I wanted the cookies.
Okay.
I don't have it. I'm out of cookies now.
I've actually run into this problem before, and where I've run into it is in various hotels and that sort of thing. And so it leads me to believe that this issue is DNS related. Something with the DNS servers in certain places. Now, maybe your provider changed their DNS server, or maybe you changed it in either your router or right there on your Mac. And it's looking for something that's not letting it get to the next stage of what Safari does, where if it fails a DNS lookup, it appends a .com and does another DNS lookup and then adds a .net or a .org. And I believe it's in that order that it will start doing its re-lookups. I think there's something happening with DNS that's stopping it from doing the next things. I may be missing something, and there may be a way of turning this setting off in Safari. I'm not aware of that. John, are you do you have any further insight on this?
You know, there's one thing I will mention here. I think this is part of this. Search domains, when you configure your TCP/IP,
right?
I believe that is a place where you can manually tack on some.
That's true. Yep.
Some things to look for, and depending on the machine you're on, and you know, I've run into this as well at my 9-to-5. There is a suffix that's assumed, but doesn't always work because some people are pointing to old DNS servers,
right.
So it doesn't tack on the part that's the usual company domain.
Right.
So it could be that somebody manually set up and it always tacks it on the end. I think that's one option. And,
yep.
And as you pointed out, the DNS configuration, depending on which ones are those hard coded, or you know, are they done through DHCP and are they being done properly?
Yep. What John's talking about is if you go into System Preferences and go to the Network Preference pane, they're on the TCP, I pick your connection, whatever it is, Ethernet, Airport, dial-up. Once you dig one level deeper in there, you'll see the five tabs, typically five, maybe four, depending on what kind of connection it is. And the first tab is always TCP/IP. Search domains is one of the options right there. And it usually, unless you know that you should be putting something in there, it should be blank.
Yeah.
However, if you're having this exact problem that Bob talks about, try putting com, comma, net, comma, org there. And see if then Safari figures it out. The only issue with doing that here is that this is a system-wide thing. So it's not just going to impact Safari. It's going to impact everything. So anytime you do a DNS lookup that fails, it's then going to also check .com, .net, .org for everything. That may or may not be what you intended.
Yeah, I'm not too happy with... Well, I thought I mentioned it because it's interesting, but yeah... I can't remember the last time I ever had to use it. If you have to use it, then something's not set up right somewhere else.
Well, yeah, that or you're using it on an internal network. I mean, here at the house, I actually have a DNS server set up. This was all set up in the pre-Bonjour Rendezvous days, and so I'd just set up a local subnet here with DNS names, and I just called it internal.network, and it works fine. But so I manually mapped it to that. or I manually put that in search domains. But that hasn't impacted Safari from being able to do its .com.net.org lookups. I'm sure if I had misconfigured our DNS server here, then it probably would, because it would stop it in its tracks. So perhaps that's what's going on. Maybe Bob's issue is something is in there and he simply needs to take it out. So who knows? But I don't. But maybe if Bob shares more about his setup, if that doesn't fix it, we can dig a little deeper there, right?
What if it has a hosts now? That's very old.
Yeah, it could be that.
Hosts file?
Yeah, there's another thing called a host file, but hosts would do something different in the old days, and I think you can still do it. It's /etc/hosts with OS 10, although you, depending on, with every rev of the OS, they keep moving that around because it's all really related to what netinfo does.
It's there, but there's not a lot in there.
The OS doesn't.
The
OS doesn't always pay attention to the changes to that file.
Yeah.
So what host does is it allows you to assign manual names, domain names, to IP addresses. So if you had set up computers in your house and you wanted to call one of them, you know, iMac and one of them PowerBook, let's say. But this was pre-Bonjour, pre-Rendezvous. And it wasn't just something that happened automatically. And instead of connecting, when you did file sharing, instead of connecting to an IP address, you know, 192.168.1.101 or whatever, you just manually map that in your host file to, you say, you know, iMac and then a tab, and or I guess it's put the IP address first. So you put 192.168.1.101 and then a tab and then iMac. And once that was in the host file, and this works on Windows, it worked on OS 9, and it kind of sort of works with OS 10, depending on how netinfo is set up. It will then, if you say connect me to iMac, bam, it knows, yep, it doesn't even do a DNS lookup. It looks at that host file first and foremost and says, yep, I know where that is, good to go. So, but that, I don't think that would impact what Bob's doing, unless that host file had some horribly malformed entries in it. But usually, usually the OS would just ignore those, but... I guess it's possible. Who knows? Luke knows something about swap files that he wanted to tell us about.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Hey, fellas. My name is Neil. I'm in Atlanta, Georgia, and I'm calling about the swap partition.
Sorry, maybe this is
Neil. You guys talked about, I think, in episode 51. There is a program out there called SwapCop, and it's available on Version Tracker. You have to have a drive available or a partition available, but it'll allow you to move your swap file from one partition to another, reboot, and delete the old partition while leaving the swap file in a new partition. So you don't actually have to do any terminal work. It's just done through the swap cop. It's pretty cool. I've used it several times myself. I like it. Performance improvements, I can't say yes or no to that, but I do like the idea of having my swap in a different place. I do that quite a bit on Windows machines that I work with. Talk to you later. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Sorry about getting your name wrong, but thanks for sending that
in,
Neil.
That was Neil, right?
That was Neil, correct. Yeah. And that sounds like a good way of experimenting if you choose to try your swap on a different drive. You know, if you've got a slow drive in your main machine, be it a laptop or even an older desktop with a slow drive in it, you may see some performance improvements. If, however, you disconnect that drive while the machine is running live, well,
oops.
Yeah, it's a pretty big oops. I think it'll probably, you may get lucky and it may not crater, but it'll probably crater.
Crater,
that's right.
Yeah. Now, I can imagine, especially if you have it on a different interface.
Correct.
Then I could see how, though some interfaces I think can, you know, multitask as far as, you know, dealing with two drives, but it's not like half speed.
Right.
To either one,
right.
But I could see that. But yeah, I want to try that just to see what will happen if the swap file is all of a sudden gone.
Well, the benefit is that you'd be running swap on a presumably if you did it on an empty partition, you'd be running swap on an unfragmented drive, and that could make a difference. The system tries to grab unfragmented space for swap on your boot drive, but if there isn't any, if you're someone who, you know, constantly is filling and moving things around in your boot drive, there may simply not be gigs and gigs of unfragmented space.
Yeah.
So,
well, it's fighting with everything else.
Yeah.
You know, I've seen this on my PowerBook especially. There are times when I'm convinced what's happening is it's having a big problem with swap, and I see through our, you know, PAL menu meters, yeah, both the read and the write will be on, and also this PowerBook G4 has a relatively slow hard drive. So sometimes I'll see it do that, yep, and I'm like, what are you doing? I think that's what it's doing, is it's
managing,
you know, doing
swap.
Some swap and doing some other deals, and you know, it brings the system to a halt sometimes, so I know something's happening because menu meter shows me that basically the drive is reading and writing. And
right.
It's like, okay, let me wait until you're done.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, and you know, we'll plug menu meters yet again, but it is a good way of knowing a little bit more about what your system's doing. Sometimes, like John just said, there's nothing you can do but wait, but it is helpful to know that, yeah, now's one of those times where I just got to chill out and let my computer do whatever it's doing, and then it'll, you know, when it's done, you can tell that it's done, and you move on, and that's that. That's why I used to like drive lights, but it seems like those have gone the way of the dinosaur, so.
And you know, I'm going to offer a I would imagine that there's probably more than one case where, say, somebody's running into this situation where, you know, the computer is doing some heavy swap activity.
Yep.
Where somebody's like, you know what, the computer's not responding. Let me shut it off. I would say that that's probably one of the worst times
to just pull the plug.
You want to remove power. You know, hold down the power button, which I think on pretty much every computer out there, every portable.
Yep.
5 seconds on the power button.
Yeah, it's
I don't know if we ever mentioned that. That's kind of a...
It's actually, that's a good little aside. That's right. A lot of people don't realize that.
If your computer, and I've had on both Macs and PCs,
Mac,
you hold down, at least on the Dells that I have, if you hold down the power button for about 5 to 10 seconds, that's shut down now.
And though, like John said, it's not necessarily recommended to do that, if the machine's locked up, it's way better to do it that way than to yank the power cord out of the back. Because when you do that, it kills power to the drive instantly. Whereas if you tell it to shut down, at least the power supply, at least the motherboard is then shutting things down. And I've seen it where people, you know, say, oh, yeah, when I have a problem, I just yank the power cord out of the back. And it's great until, you know, they cause irreparable damage to their hard drive or something, and then that's it. Because remember, there's grounding that happens with that power supply, too. And if you pull the power cord out, you stand a chance of arcing something and, you know, letting the magic smoke out. So that's not good smoke to let out.
Magic smoke. Oh,
yeah. You know
that's
what the magic smoke. That's what
makes the thing that makes computers and electronics work.
That's
because
right.
When they don't work,
when you let the magic smoke out, it stops working. So I assume that that's what the stuff that makes it work, right?
But yeah, another thing I do, and some people look at me oddly when I do this, is sometimes listen to see if the hard drive's doing anything.
Yeah.
A lot of times, if your system looks dead, I'll, you know, put my ear to the keyboard where the hard drive is, you know, hidden there somewhere, and if I hear it chattering or doing something on the hard drive, I'm like, okay, I'll believe that the computer is actually working on something
and
not ground to a halt.
It's good to get your
drive light should do that, and I'm with Dave that, you know, lights, you know, blinking lights are good.
Yeah.
But tell me what the heck the machine is doing.
I used to like my modem lights too back in the day, but I got over that a while ago too. So doesn't mean that I wouldn't like them back though. So, and maybe that's why I'm so obsessed with menu meters, because I grew up with computers that had drive lights and you know, modem lights and all that. So there was a lot more visual confirmation that the computer was doing something as opposed to just a spinning beach ball, which, you know, who knows whatever that means.
It's almost like cars, you know. I mean, for a while there, though, I think on some high end, you know, vehicles, you don't have this problem. But it's like check engine. It's like,
thanks.
Yeah, it's there.
Yeah, you don't get temperature sensors. You don't get, you know, RPM indicator. You get check engine. It's like, well, does it need oil, or, you know, do I need to run screaming from the car? You know, don't know. Check the engine.
I want a tach. I want an ammeter. I want
right.
You know, I want nice analog gauges. And I've seen that on a lot of cars.
Hey, did you see that thing, Stuart? Huh? That thing Stuart sent us, where the folks at Creative Mac have done a series of benchmarks with the 13-inch MacBook compared to the MacBook Pro and older PowerBooks.
Yeah,
excellent.
You know, it struck me. I thought my you know, my G5 here, dual G5, was fast, but apparently on quite a few tasks, except for one, there was one task where I think the MacBook Pro really pigged, and I don't know why. Pig being it went very slow, but other than that, yeah, I looked at the review, and it gives you a good feel for the
there's not a whole lot of difference between the MacBook Pro and the MacBook, you know, from what this guy found, right? I mean, did you see anything that
no, they were very, very close.
Yeah,
I mean, well, essentially, as we commented before, I mean, many of the components are pretty much the same. There's not as big, like, you know, the bus speed and things like that, that or the cache that used to be one differentiator between the two lines. Now and as we commented too, it was surprising they didn't do the single versus dual.
Yeah.
Hey, it's good for everybody. Everybody gets dual processors or dual core.
Yeah, which for a lot of what goes on is effectively the same. Just having another core to pass off tasks to makes a big difference. I noticed that as soon as I got my dual G4, the one that I actually use now for the podcast here. Even when both processors weren't pegged, even when it wasn't using mm-hmm. all of the CPU power, just simply having that other CPU to do something at the same time, it made a difference, especially with, you know, just mm-hmm. finder operations and overall general snappiness, if you will.
Yeah, there's some people difference. That would howl at what you said about, you know, a dual core being the same as two separate. I believe they share cache, and
they
that,
do. Right.
So it's more than one, but less than two.
Correct.
Let's say that.
Correct. Well, and it's another core. It's not a completely separate processor. Absolutely.
Now I did notice. Yeah, it was compressor 2.1. One of the benchmarks. This is the only thing that jumped out at me. Test 3. If this is correct.
Yeah.
The G5 was five and a half minutes. The 15-inch MacBook Pro was 9 minutes.
Yeah, and he seemed to think that there was the firmware updates that hadn't been put out there yet when he did the initial MacBook Pro test. That I think was his assumption was the issue there. Yeah,
but that's
because it doesn't make sense otherwise. You're right.
But to that performance, because for those that do have a G5 desktop. Yeah. There's some pretty mighty heat sinks in there.
Yeah. Yeah.
Which you're not going to get in a portable.
No.
But I think it's pretty much, it's this is about the same performance as a G5, but in a nice portable form factor, which
I
think is one reason why Steve wanted to go over to Intel.
It could be. Yeah. That's right.
Could be.
I'm sure that. Oh, of course. Yeah. Since I missed this, I figured I might as well mention it. You know, I took the Amtrak again on Thursday to do a round trip from here to New York and back on Thursday. And I was on the train, and I'd noticed this issue here at my desk before, but hadn't really paid attention to it, and certainly missed all the articles that were written about it, and there were plenty. I have obviously one of the first round of MacBook Pros that came off the assembly line. And I'm on the train, and you started using the battery, and it said I had, like 3 hours left. I thought, oh, this is killer. And there's a plug right there, but I thought, well, it's good to let the battery run down, and I got some time, so I'll just let it go. And so down and down went the battery, and it got to about the 66% mark, and then all of a sudden the computer just shut off. It wasn't no warning, no nothing. I pushed the button on the back of the battery, to see what the status is. Zilch.
Yeah.
Nothing. So
really,
yeah. So I reached into my bag and I got the power adapter. I plugged it in and fired the thing back up. And instantly it said that it was at 66%. So I flipped it over and pushed the button, or I didn't even have to, because since it was charging, it showed me. And it had 3 out of 5 lights on. I thought, okay, well, wait a minute. What's going on here? So I didn't want to mess with it anymore on the train. I did let it charge itself back up while I was working. And I tested it on my desk here when I got back on Friday. And same thing, right? It gets to that 66% mark and dies. I did it like 3 times, and finally I called Apple, and I hadn't put AppleCare on this, and I'm just outside of the 90 days, and the guy's like, well, tell me what's going on, but I have to get your credit card for phone support, and then if it turns out to be hardware, it's free. The same kind of thing. And so I said, that's fine. I said, let me tell you what's going on. I told him, I said, I've troubleshot this. I'm convinced it's the battery. And he said, what's the serial number on the battery? And so I took the battery out and I read it to him. It was started 6N606. And he's like, yeah, you've got a faulty battery. He's like, give us your address. We'll send you a new one right away. And so I did some searching.
Ow.
Yeah, I did some searching, apparently.
So you didn't have to say, do you know who I am?
No, I did not. I'm sure he knew. I'm sure he listens to the podcast and knew my voice. No,
apparently. So it was the power status deal in the battery then?
No, it was my assumption based on my knowledge of how batteries are created is that and this is a known issue. It's a quote unquote silent recall of all these batteries, at least according to what I've read in the press. And this probably happened 2 months ago that all these reports came out, and I just happened to miss them. Uh-huh. Batteries have multiple cells in them, right? And so I think the problem is that there's a bad cell, or at least a bad connection to one of the cells in the battery. And when it goes, you know, to use that one, that's it. It's over. So, I'm almost certain it's a bad cell or a bad connection to the cell. So, but anyway, my new battery arrived this morning. So. We're in good shape.
Yeah. You know, I have to think about that, thinking if you put either things in series or parallel.
Yeah.
Yeah, because I know there is a chip inside of the battery that basically says, hey, this is how much I got left.
Right, right.
And
right.
If that doesn't match reality.
Correct.
Maybe that was it.
No.
Was it saying 66 and you think it was really zero?
No. It was 66 if all the cells were good. Yeah. Because it hadn't been running long enough to get down to zero. You know, it was doing what I would have expected it to do. And all the reports, I read indicated the same kind of thing. So.
Yeah, I'd like to rip one apart and see what's going on there. But hey,
if I give it to you, you have to give me $121 because that's what Apple will bill me if I don't send it back to them. You want it?
No.
In the interest of, you know, science?
No, but hey, they... you know, no hassle, though they didn't act. Did you register your product?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Huh.
Yeah.
So it's not, maybe it's not a large enough scale recall, because I know they've had them
well,
in the
remember,
past.
Well, remember, there's no, they may not know what serial number battery I have just based on the serial number of my PowerBook, or my MacBook, rather, Pro, rather. I think that could potentially be the issue. They may, you know, I don't know that they have any way of knowing at all what sort of battery, what sort of battery I have.
Yep.
Right? All right.
Right.
We've got this question about this printer sharing thing keeps coming up, and I wanted to see if we could address this quick.
Hey, John and Dave. I'm listening to your MacGeek Gab 55, and you're talking about printers. And I just wanted to throw another monkey in the wrench. I have a Canon PIXMA IP6600D, which we just bought recently. And I hooked it up to my wife's G4 Mini via USB, and it saw everything just fine. It had all the printing options that you would expect, and I shared it. And then on my system, which was a Core Duo Mac Mini, viewing it as a shared printer, I only got a subset of the options. So I couldn't do a lot of things like set the quality and look at some of the color options and so forth. So what I wound up doing, and I downloaded the newest drivers from Canon. I upgraded them. I completely wiped out the original drivers and installed. I mean, I did several things trying to combat this problem. What I finally wound up doing was I finally hooked it up to my computer and via USB and then shared it to hers, and hers had only the subset. But in this case, when I downloaded the new drivers, the updated drivers to her computer and installed them, all of a sudden she had the full set of printing options. So for some reason, when I connect it to my computer via USB and share it to hers, even though we have the identical drivers, she can see the full set of options viewing it as a shared printer. But if I view it as a shared printer and not connected directly via USB, I only get a subset. So now we're both happy now that it's connected to mine and sharing to hers. But it's kind of weird. I've never seen anything like this. I haven't really had a lot of experience with, this is the first time I've ever bought a new printer and tried to share it onto Macs. So that was my experience. Lots of fun. Take care. Talk.
Well, that certainly is strange. But what I did hear, John, is that his wife is running a G4 Mini and he's running an Intel Mini. Is it possible that the Canon drivers, though may appear to be the same, are different? You know, USB printer, right? Canon, I mean, the drivers have got to be written for the platform. So is it possible that even though they look to be the same, we're running two different pieces of software there, and it just so happens that they're interacting differently?
Eureka.
You think that's it?
Well, seeing as how like the software updates, which we just got another one the other
day. That's right, 10.4.7, yeah.
Have Intel and PowerPC versions. And I do remember that was one thing brought up when people were talking about the migration, is that low-level device drivers, in all likelihood, would have to be rewritten for the new platform. They would not go through the emulation
Rosetta. That's right. Yeah.
Environment, Rosetta. The other things will, when you start wrapping with the hardware at a low level, then you got to recode it. So, that's a good one. It's still annoying how you get different levels of functionality.
Yeah.
Whether you're directly connected or trying to share over the network or wireless or whatever.
That's right. You know, again, as we've mentioned with this, remember, these printers are not, the printer itself isn't doing the sharing. It's the OS that's doing the sharing. So there's a whole nother level of integration that either exists or doesn't exist, depending on a lot of factors. One of them is simply luck, and then the other is, did the application vendor bother to go and spend the time to test it this way, and if they found something that was not consistent, did they bother to fix it this way? And we don't know the answers to any of that. You know, it may simply be luck allows you to use it one way and not the other, and that's just kind of one of those things. You know, you can only expect the manufacturers to test it to a given point. Beyond that, whatever capability you decide to add, you know, just like similar thing with our cable modems, right? You know, or our DSL. They say, look, here's your cable modem. You get one IP. It's DHCP, you know, dynamically assigned, and good to go. Now, they don't, in fact, it's policy that you are even allowed to put a router on there and share it. They don't care. It used to be that they cared and they would come and, you know, try and bust you, but now they don't care. They realize that it doesn't matter. But they're not going to support your router, you know, even, and the router, you know, the router company, you know, Linksys or whoever you buy it from may or may not support, you know, any wackiness that goes on with your cable company, you know. So it's one of those things where the kind of the onus falls on you. But that's why we're here. However,
why are we here?
I don't know. We didn't really have an answer for him. So maybe that's not why we're here. You know, John, there were a lot of, some news popped up this weekend, as I'm sure you saw, because our email boxes got filled with this stuff, where some of these folks are telling us that there's... Did you see the CNET article about cell phones?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Where they're saying that... the article said a couple of interesting things. One was that they did some tests. Now, I guess these tests they did weren't recent, but whatever. They're publishing the results either again or anew. And they said basically that driving and talking on a cell phone impaired people to the same level as driving while drunk, or maybe even more so. And drunk too at what, a 0.08, I think, alcohol level? Is that what it was? Which I thought was very interesting. And obviously it dovetails right into the conversation that we've sort of been dancing around here. And since we've actually gotten a ton of emails about this, so we might as well make this one of our recurring themes here. I'd love to hear you folks chime in on this, because it's a fascinating thing. Obviously, you know, John and I are both very passionate about our thoughts here. And I think part of that passion, you know, John, at least from my standpoint, is, well, you know, if I can't talk, I've just become so used to being able to hold a conversation in the car that, you know, heaven forbid they take that, you know, that liberty away from me, right? But if it's proven that this is dangerous to others, well, you know, maybe it does need to be taken away, right?
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Maybe John, there should be a test.
Maybe there should be, well, yeah, but then, but what's that mean? I mean, should there also be a test for how well you're able to drive drunk, right? I mean, that's not really...
Well, that's really already there. That test is already there, I think, but... No, I think we should have constant monitoring of all vehicle operations. Like I saw the other day, and it was someone definitely was on the phone. So driving the, monstrosity SUV, on the highway, and all of a sudden, you know, I'm kind of behind them, say following distance. All of a sudden, they slow down for no reason. I'm like, gee, you know, I wonder what's going on. Pull around them, you know, look over my shoulder, which is one point. people brought up, which I always do because you got a blind spot. Look over your shoulder before you, and you signal. And I look, and the person's yapping on the cell phone.
Yep.
A little later, then they started paying attention. They overtook me, and then I saw them do something which caused another SUV to swerve because this person basically, because they were yakking on the phone, they couldn't look in their blind spot. They basically, and of course they didn't use the turn signal, just kind of meandered over into a spot where there was already another vehicle, which had to swerve. If they didn't swerve, there would have been a catastrophe and I may not be here.
Wow.
And I'm just looking. I'm like, this is a perfect example. Now, it's one in 1,000, 10,000, a million.
Yep, that's
but
right.
But this is definitely due to someone not being able to handle maneuvering this monstrosity and having another hand. And maybe there were kids in the back that they were screaming at. Who knows?
Sure.
There's just there's a point where, and I think you're okay in this, there's a point where there's too much going on.
That's right.
There's too much stimulus. There's too much happening.
Yep.
And you know, get rid of one of them. You could either, you know, jettison the kids.
Or, wow. No. Wow. Want to talk on the phone? Jettison your children. New ejector seats from Acme Corp, you know.
I would dig that.
That
the ejector
would be
seat with like a parachute or something?
Oh.
If the parents just get too occupied with talking on the phone and driving, you get shot home. That'd be awesome. Whatever happened to the Jetsons? We just missed out on a lot of the good stuff. Well, remember they had that bubble for
I remember. Yeah,
Elroy.
For the kids, for Elroy, You know, the one interesting thing that this article said, actually it said a couple of interesting things. Now, of course, this is one study, and I'm always suspect of studies, even if they, you know, even if the results are something that, you know, falls in line with my own beliefs or wishes or whatever, is that studies are rarely commissioned by someone who really has no interest in the outcome being one way or another, right? I mean, it's nearly impossible to do something like this and do it with no bias going in. But you know, that being said, we'll take it at face value. So it said that it didn't matter the way they did the test. They did it both with and without people using handsets or headsets rather, and they said it didn't matter. It was more the distraction of the conversation, exactly what you were saying before. That was the issue. What they also said was that it was the same level of distraction caused by talking to someone in the passenger seat as it was by talking on the cell phone. Same thing. So
that goes against my instinct, and I think your instinct, or at least my instinct was, person there can, it's different than a person that's not there at all.
Right, right. But they're saying it was the same. So... Which actually to me makes sense, you know, that it should conversation's a conversation and that's that. So the issue is, yes, there are all these distractions. What they haven't done, of course, is, or maybe they have, but they certainly haven't made a big deal out of it, is how much distraction comes from futzing with the radio, right? How much distraction comes from, turning the wipers on and off? How much distraction comes from simply driving in the rain, right? You know, there's all these things. Where do we, the real question is, you know, okay, we know that there are these things that to one degree or another distract us. Alcohol impairment is something that, you know, has at least, you know, democratically anyway, been agreed that, yes, this is, you know, an issue. We cannot have people driving under the influence of a certain amount of alcohol. Where do we draw the line for the rest of this stuff? I mean, do we say, no, you can't have an iPod in the car, right? Because an iPod connected to a cord plugged into your, you know, your cassette deck or whatever. I mean, I know, frankly, I get more distracted with the iPod than I do with a cell phone. You know, once you're in the conversation, or at least for me, once I'm in the conversation, it's not a distraction. I always wear a headset because it's just easier for me. It's more comfortable. Mm-hmm. And I can have two hands free to actually drive the vehicle. But what do you do with, with the folks that are using an iPod? When I'm navigating through playlists and the kids are saying, oh, pick this song, or if I want to hear a certain song, there's a lot of distraction there.
I think you should teach the kids to do that for their own.
You know what? The kids have actually started doing it. Skylar's totally at home with the iPod. Yeah.
You said,
but if I'm alone in the car.
Pick your own music.
Yeah. Yeah.
Who do you think I am? Come on, I'm operating this vehicle. I can't do this for you.
So share your thoughts with us. We would absolutely love to hear what you have to say on this and anything else we discussed. But I don't think we're going to be here next week because I don't think the technology exists to allow us to do a show. I'm at the lake from Saturday to Saturday. And
the lake. They don't have internet at the lake, do they?
Actually, I've been told that they have some sort of satellite high-speed thing, but I don't know, man. So we may, it may be 2 weeks. So we let this show go a little extra long. You can savor it or simply enjoy having a week that, where we don't burst ourselves into your home via your aggregator. Don't forget to go to Portable Media Expo in September. You've downloaded this from Cashfly Hosting. And if you want to sponsor us, call the Backbeat Media Podcast Network. Cool new programs with this podcast marketplace you do not want to miss. That's that. That's it, right? Send your stuff to us at MacGeekab at MacObserver.com. Skype it to MacGeekab. What's the phone number, John? You're killing me.
Geek.
206-666-GEEK.
Got it.
Thanks, folks. Have a great 4th of July tomorrow if you're hearing this on the 3rd. Don't get caught.